great to see everyone here. Some of us with Underground Seminary have put together this presentation about the Bible. And it's unlike what I learned at seminary. I mean, like, a lot of the content is similar. Plus, we're talking about the Bible. But the angle we have on the Bible, those of us who went to seminaries and Bible colleges related to denominations, even if they're not officially affiliated with the denomination, but were founded by it, will have a theological slant, naturally. Mine did too. But when we try to understand the Bible through its actual historical roots, when it was written, by whom, and what was happening in the world at that time, we get kind of a different angle, I think a far deeper angle, and then the Bible becomes much more relevant than we ever thought it might. So that's what's exciting for me. For me, my journey into this way of understanding the scripture has only deepened my understanding of God, my commitment to God and Jesus Christ, and my rock solid conviction that the Bible is the Word of God. But with a much deeper basis for that than the kind of doctrinal basis that I had before. So I think this is going to be a really exciting 4 weeks. I hope everyone will do this as fully as possible. And we think that this is something that the world desperately needs. But we are all kind of like guinea pigs here. We haven't really opened this up to the broader outside our church community, because we're going to try to work out the bugs in our midst, and your questions and your comments will be important, and as we get better at this, then we hope to make this a gift to those outside our church. Dana has been a longtime teacher of the Bible in our church, and her input has been important. I'll also recognize Isaac. Where's Isaac Sanborn? Who's done a lot of the research. He is truly research assistant par excellence, as we say in Korean. And John will be our primary instructor for these next 4 weeks. And it's been just a wonderful thing to learn with him and teach with him in our seminary. The mastermind of this whole series is really Laura Newby. You know, the passion behind even starting Underground Seminary was, how do we learn without all the nonsense of formalities and positions and degrees and credentials and then reputation and rising up the ecclesiastical hierarchy, just wanting to learn about God with no other agenda besides that? And then what would seminary look like if it was just about that and not about preparing for some specialization or professional credentialing? And Laura's special interest is in making theology, the Bible, and then understanding the world through our theological lens accessible to the average person. And we'll see, like, when we study church history, I don't know if we're going to cover that, but one of the things, you know, we're going through in our seminary right now is how, after Constantine basically co-opted the church into the empire, there began to be a serious divide between the regular people and the clergy. And the clergy began to wear special vestments. That didn't happen until after Constantine. And specializations of every kind, so that clergy looked like imperial officials rather than pastors to the people. So how do we do theological education where we're all on the same page, basically, with a similar framework, and where we're all equipped to proclaim the good news without thinking, how many people said, well, I don't know what to say because I've never been to seminary, right? Mm-hmm. Do you know that for the first 300 years, nobody said something like that? Everyone was equipped to share the good news out of their own experience and learning of the scriptures and life together in community. So we're really trying to capture the spirit of the early church again, and we feel like we live in times where the early church is a more compelling and necessary model than ever before. The era of Christendom that Constantine inaugurated And by the way, I don't have anything against Constantine personally. He represents an era, you know. As a Roman emperor, he was pretty effective. If you're a fan of the Roman Empire, but from the church's point of view, that was a slide into church-state fusion, which has been a source of deep compromise of Christian discipleship ever since. So we're trying to untangle all that by understanding the Bible in its historical roots rather than its ideological angle. Does that kind of make sense? So before John teaches, I'm going to ask Laura to say a few more words about that. But really, special thanks to our mastermind, Laura Newby.
I'm excited about Passions of the Average Person because I'm an average person, and I don't like reading and research, so I want someone to just tell me what's going on so that I can go and live with that kind of basis for my life and go do the other things that I love to do. So... our goal with this series, we titled this The Gospel of Jesus, is to really understand how Jesus is was relevant in his time and in our time today, and really what he was saying to the powers and principalities of his age, and why his message was truly so radical. And it's really exciting, I think, when we get at that, and what's really going on, and the connections start to be made. I've gone through a transformation in our church over the last 10 years, in understanding the Bible in new and deep and rooted and relevant ways, and then through our seminary as well. And so we're trying to bring some of that in 4 weeks here in 2 hours a night. So it's a bit of a challenge. We've spent several months putting this together, trying to take all of this information that we studied in the seminary and put it into a framework and a story and an outline that gives us the essential story of what's happening in the Bible and what's happening in Jesus' time in particular. So we debated how long to make this series. We were going to go 6 weeks because we thought that with the amount of information, the amount of story we're going to tell, it would require that. The problem was we run up into, some of us are going to Yucatan in 5 weeks, we'll be there, and then we have Ash Wednesday, and so we didn't want to have a two-week break in between. And then our goal was to start to have the series ready by the inauguration. So I think we're all feeling what's going on under Trump, and our faith is more important than ever during this time. So we really wanted to have a good word and to bring ourselves together during such a time as this. So we had a little bit of restraint time-wise, so we're going to have a lot of information, but hopefully not too much so that it's overwhelming. But as we go throughout, we're going to... if you have questions, we're going to try to not get muddled down in too many details, but if you have clarifying questions, please feel free to ask as we go along. And then we've kind of got this broken into 4 sections for the night, and we'll have a little bit of discussion after each section. And then at the end, for those who are able to stay, we'll have time for more conversation as well. So I'm sorry we weren't able to build in more back and forth as we go along. There'll be some of that, but what we are going to do as well is we have two... like I said, we'll have conversation afterwards for those who want to stay. Class will go to 8:30, and then we'll hang out and talk for a while. And then, let's see, on February 12th and 19th, we have 2 crosstalk spaces that are open. So if anybody just wants to get together and process what we're learning in here and talk about it together, has questions or whatever, we'll just do that informally during those times. And then, of course, if you have other questions that didn't get answered in any of those other formats, you know, feel free to... take John out for coffee, or Isaac, or Pastor Jane, or me, I'll do my best. let's see, so a couple things. 4 weeks, we're just going straight, so come here, same time, same place next week. Dana could not be here tonight, she really sends her regrets, she really wanted to be here, she's been a big part of this, and her spirit is really a part of this as well. And if you've had any classes with her, you'll see her influence in here as well. So she's also available if anyone wants to talk to her with follow-up. Jinsu, are we recording?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is recording. Okay, so there were some people who couldn't make it to every series, so we're going to try to have these recordings available. So I'm sure Jinsu will send that out afterwards. Yeah.
Somehow. Let's see how well it records first.
If you are able to make a donation for tonight to help cover the cost of food and such, we suggested $50 for the 4 series, but if whatever you can afford will help to cover costs, and it's totally fine. So you can give that to me, or we have a basket out there. And I think that's it. Oh, so 4 weeks, As you can see, we're starting with the Old Testament. We're going back. We're really going to try to lay the foundation so that especially in week four, when we get to the gospel in Jesus' time, you're going to really see the payoff. I think it's going to be exciting. So that's why we're talking about the gospel. It says the Old Testament story here, in case you were wondering. And then we do have handouts. So the handouts are an outline of what John is going to be presenting tonight. The PowerPoint is doesn't have all this information, but it's in here. So you can follow along in here if you like, or you can just know that it's here for you if you want it. And then we also just have a basic map of the Middle East, just so if you need it for reference, you've got something a little bit closer to you. So I'll pass these out and then turn it over to John.
Thanks, Laura. Hi, everybody. I'm really excited to be doing this. It's a little bit different than anything we've done so far. We have been gathering for the last almost 3 years now with our seminary cohort for 3 hours or so a day just to read books and to talk. And it's been book discussions where I, Pastor Jim, Laura, we're all kind of learning along with the students. The seminary has really been, it's kind of been my own re-education. I did a couple of seminary degrees, and I think what I learned out of that is a lot of white Western theology and all the different ways that it emerged. And then I came to this church and had to start really wrestling with that as a result of so many different relationships and mentors and teachers here in this congregation. So part of what you're going to hear as we walk through the Bible again here over the next 4 weeks is grappling with the implications of that, kind of going back and rereading the text, reading different scholars who were not coming at it through the Western theological lens, and taking history and politics really seriously as we try to understand the stories. I think I've also been seeing the critical relevance of this work the last month and a half, post-election. We know that 81% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. And I really want to understand all the different things that can lead to the results in an election like that. So I think we're going to see some of that as we unpack the text and go through this. It is going to be probably a different approach than a lot of us are used to. We're going to be touching on some different stories. I'll read some examples of stuff in the Old Testament, but I'm really trying to tell the story of an emergence of a people, of the Israelite people. A lot of it rooted in historical work, archaeological work, sociological work, and then out of that, piecing together how these texts came together. Because you'll see that it really matters, and it will help us understand a couple of different currents that are present within the Jewish tradition. And what all the debates and struggles are within Judaism. What are the arguments within Judaism, and what is the larger context that they're having these arguments within? Because then when we get to Jesus, we're going to see where Jesus lands on that question. Jesus is actually very consciously relating to a very specific part of the Jewish tradition, and very consciously challenging and opposing another part of the Jewish tradition. If we don't see all of that, we're going to miss a lot of what's going on in the Gospels. So that's where we're starting. That is the background. And I'm going to start us in kind of a strange place. We're going to get really grounded historically and even further back, geologically. We're going to try to understand a little bit about the rise of civilization, what was happening. Because that very much informs what's starting to take place in the Fertile Crescent with the ancient Israelites. So, and after each section, we'll take a break for a few minutes for some questions. For me, because I grew up reading the Bible and grew up in church, for me, my understanding of history starts with the Old Testament and with the Genesis account. So I tend to think about history starting, however long ago you date that, whether if you're in more conservative churches, 7,000 years or so, or even if you date it further back, still my imagination and consciousness of history starts there. Of course, human beings, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, have been around for at least 1.6, 1.7 million years. So we're talking about a time frame that we're going to be exploring here in the last 10,000 years, a really tiny blip in the expanse of human history of 1.6 million years, where a lot of things change really, really fast in the big scheme of things. If you're just looking at 10,000 years, it looks like they're changing kind of slowly. And the early Israelite people represent an example of a people early on in a context where a lot is changing, wrestling with all the changes that are taking place and seeking to respond, even to move away from and to resist in different ways, even as they're mixed up in it as well. So I have here the Pleistocene epoch. This is a geological term, but it's just an era where every 100,000 years or so, the ice sheets would retreat. There'd be kind of a warming period. Human beings were migrating back and forth based on when the ice sheets were coming down, going back. Laura, if you go to the next slide, just to make it... go to the next one, actually, two ahead. I don't know how to go back. Just to connect it to where we're at, this is the last one in 12,000 BCE that went down, I think, all the way to Des Moines, the Des Moines lobe here, and where ice sheets were just covering this region before they began to retreat again a couple thousand years later. You can go back now. So this was just a period that went back and forth, but what we have is human beings living in more of a hunter-gathering way, with primarily relying on perennial plants. Perennial plants being those that you don't replant every year, have very deep root systems, very mature, tend to relate, be interconnected with each other. There's not a tilling of the soil. It's you can manage it. You can have fires, you cut it down, and you can work to manage perennial spaces, and there was a lot of that. But you're relating with the plants in a different way, and you would have more band and tribal structures throughout this time. So I have this slide here just to show you what perennial plants look like, because the roots, most of the life is all underground. It goes very, very deep. And so even as these plants die, they contribute to the soil, everything is returned to the soil, and it continues to generate new healthy soil and new life. What we have here at the very end is annual grasses. So that's wheat is one example. I mean, all of the annual crops that we grow or started to grow are annual grasses. They're weeds. They're pioneer species. They move into an area and they take over an area really fast. They colonize a space really, really fast. They dig up the ground. They dig up the soil when soil has been laid bare. But they're very competitive with each other. Eventually, more mature plants are going to grow in a space, going to develop deeper root systems, and contribute to the health of that overall ecosystem through the process of succession. So this is, it'll connect, I promise. But this is part of what was going on for most of our 1.6 million year history was a reliance on prairie plants, trees, perennial plants, and learning to relate in a very intimate way. If you go forward, so I showed you that ice sheet. This is just another one. Basically, a lot of the Midwest, just to see what was going on here, at different periods of glaciation was covered, except for an area in southern Wisconsin, southeast Minnesota, that's called the Driftless Area, much more hilly because it was never flattened out. So this is the what is called now the breadbasket, which was a lot of prairie grass, scattered trees, developed amazing soil as a result of all that. Go forward. So there was a shift at this time period. It moves us forward to the Holocene epoch around 10,000 to 9,000 BCE. From 12,000 to 10,000, the ice sheets start to recede again. So in... go forward. Let me talk about the next one real quick. This is just showing the process of succession. So this is pioneer species, weeds, until we move to perennials and healthier systems. Okay. So in this area now, this is the Fertile Crescent. This is where major shifts start to occur in this 1.6 million year history in terms of how human beings related to their environment, and especially how they got their food. So it was a shift from food gatherers to food producers. And part of what happened is with the ice sheets, a lot of the moisture was locked up in the higher areas in the mountains. So up here you have the Zargas Mountains, just north up here. When the ice sheets melted this last time, it all flowed down and formed a couple of rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates River. So the people that were up in the mountains, closer to some of the moisture in the water and all the plants and stuff that followed, started to move back down to the foot of the mountains again. And it's at the foot of the mountains up there in the top north, northeast corner of the Fertile Crescent that we have the first experiments with annual plants. Wheat is planted for the first time, domesticated, a grass, a weed, that a pioneer species, that using seeds, they're able to repropagate and start to do annual agriculture, which relies on tilling the ground, breaking up that soil that has been forming for a long time, breaking up that soil, and then planting again and again. With the domestication of plants is the domestication of animals, and from around, you see the spread of farming, from around 9,000 BC to 7,000 BC, this whole area quickly, especially along the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, and then later on, we'll see down along the Nile and Egypt, villages start to form, settled villages. We know that this is a long process of formation, but by around 5,000 BCE, so from 8,500 BCE to about 5,000 BCE, there are now sizable villages forming up in Mesopotamia in the northeast corner and are starting to look to expand. From 5,000 to 3,000 BCE in this area, we have right between the Tigris and the Euphrates in this region, we start to have the channeling of the water. So we have dikes being built to stop the flooding. Because every time a rainfall would come, it's a watershed, so it would land on the mountains, it would come down, it would go through the rivers, and it would bring a lot of rich soil, especially with flooding, down into these lower-lying regions. So people started to discover that they could actually follow that, move down there, and if they could figure out a way to control the water a little bit, they could form settlements that... they could grow a lot of annual plants. They could have surplus. You start growing annual plants, and then if you learn to store it and keep it, you can have surplus. This leads to a population explosion, way more numbers. So then you got to expand more, and you got to find more places to plant, and this continues. And then you got to figure out a way to guard and protect your surplus. So then you need to start building walls and... Then you need people to protect it, so you need police and you need armies, and there's just kind of a snowball effect that happens here in this region. So, now agriculture did start emerging around other parts of the world too, including Mesoamerica and South America, North America, and Asia. It took different shapes in different areas. This is the shape that it took here. It matters because it's out of this area and the spread, as we'll see, that eventually shifts and starts to form Western civilization. So that's why we're starting here right now, to understand these shifts. So between the Tigris and Euphrates, for about 2,000 years, between 5,000 to 3,000 BCE, the northeast part of this area, people live pretty well. Those who are part of these communities and have access to it, they have figured out how to control, harness the water, and it's producing a surplus year after year. Eventually a city emerges, the first early city, and that is, we have it listed here, let's see if it's on your, on your map. You have Sumer on the top right on the map that you have. You have Sumer, and then Sumer lasts from like 2900 to 2400 or so. And then you have Akkad. Sumer and Akkad represent, especially Akkad, the first real empire, where there's real expansion that starts to occur. There is, with this growing food surplus, there is a shift in the way people relate to each other. There's growing hierarchies that start to emerge. Thank you. Pretty soon you have hierarchies, and you start to, in these regions, have kings and rulers. And we'll look at what this looks like in the Bible. But there is fast happening centralization occurring, which is leading to cities. And cities are able to grow because they bring in all the surplus from the surrounding areas. So they keep spreading out in terms of agriculture around the region. That means they have to go and find new region to settle and to dig up the soil, to plant, to do all of that. One thing that happened is that people were not really very quick to convert to settled monocrop agriculture. So you start to see, and we actually have hints of this in the Bible, you start to see a lot of warfare and bloodshed. As those who have become agriculturalists and start to actually mirror the very species that they're growing, they actually start to mirror pioneer species weeds in terms of them going into areas quick, not having deep roots, and just like colonizing areas. And that's what's happening here. So a very different social formation starts to emerge with these cities. In the northern part, again, you have Sumer, Akkad, Syria, a few... Ur should be familiar to us from the Bible if you remember the story of Abraham. Babylon, eventually. And then in the south, we also have around similar time as Sumer and Akkad, we have Egypt. And Egypt, in about 2900 or 3000 BCE, a couple of smaller kingdoms in Egypt come together, and they have a pharaoh who, the king, interprets this as being willed by the gods. And so a theology starts to emerge around this pharaoh, this king. And we see that every city that is built in this time period, one of the first things they do is build a temple. Temples are really important in this time. It becomes a place of worship, and it becomes a place of ideological justification, a way of it telling a story, a religious story, to justify, to make sense of the city, the empire that is taking shape. And right around 3000 BCE, we also have writing for the first time, mainly to take accounts between people, eventually to take records, census. It's a political tool, and only the elites have access to it. So you start to have mythologies being put down as well, stories, creation stories, in each of these cities and these empires. Sumer has their creation story. Akkad has their creation story. Egypt has their creation stories. Okay, you go to the next one. I give all this as background quickly, and we're going to talk about the early Genesis stories a lot more next week. But as a little bit of background for some things that we start to hear and that the text is hinting at to us early on. Genesis 3. This is why I talk so much about perennials and annuals. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. Thorns and thistles are pioneer species. They're weeds. They're the more immature species in the process of succession that once you break up, once you have bare ground, they come in and they colonize the space really fast. Once you have more mature plants, perennials, then you don't have quite the same issue with them. So it's pointing to this process, and you shall eat the plants of the field. So you shall eat the plants out of your planting. It's going to be a lot of work. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground, for out of it, bread of course coming from wheat, for out of it you were taken, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. This is a longer passage. I think Jim Bear has preached on this recently, not so long ago, and he talks some about this. But if you go through this whole passage, you start to see a lot of descriptions of things that are taking place with the shift from perennials and the fall into, I would call this a fall into monocrop agriculture. We'll explore how this is a story that emerged later on in Israel's history. So if we're wondering if it's like a factual thing, actually telling historical people and stuff, that's not the role that this story plays of Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. But it is a story, I think, that is reflecting an ecological fact. And that ecological fact is part of what, in the Fertile Crescent, I just narrated, this move towards monocrop agriculture and all the resulting effects of it. As we go through the Genesis account, we're going to see all kinds of that things playing out there in the first 11 chapters, culminating with the Tower of Babel. So it's an ecological fact, and it's a story. It's from a people trying to tell the story of how in the world they got to where they are now. And we'll end class today with where they are when they're telling that story. Yes.
Can I just break in for a second?
Yep.
This is such a critical part of our framing, this very slide right here. You know how Jesus often says, "Ye have heard it said, the convention of wisdom, but I say unto you." Most of us were raised to believe in the convention of wisdom that human beings live very, very harsh, cruel, mean lives when we were hunters and gatherers. And with the advent of monocrop agriculture, we began to have surpluses and live well. Genesis tells the exact opposite story. And when we think about the recession of the Ice Age and the rivers gave so much bounty, it was really like paradise. There was food for everyone. But once people moved into monocrop agriculture and then the cities and civilizations and empires that it gave rise to, then farming became toil. So this intensive farming is actually the curse, whereas before that, people just ate naturally from everything that grew in the ground, and the population was relatively stable and matched the yield of the earth. So this is the reversal here that is so critical for us to understand. That modern agriculture, as we know it, is actually the curse that Genesis, early Genesis, is pointing to.
Thank you. Yeah, and we'll get back to that. We'll spend a lot of time on that next class, too, at the beginning. But one thing you said, I mean, one of the reasons this really matters, and why we'll come back to this a lot, is because in the Western Church, we've tended to read, starting with the Old Testament onward, as a story of continual progress. Salvation history, progress, and this gives it a very different lens, and it complicates things in the text, but I think it opens up much deeper meaning in stories of the text too. Jinder?
So, I mean, adding to this notion of the curse, when you're foraging perennials, that is an incredibly healthy ecosystem, and it's 100% sustainable.
Yeah.
And then the tie to the land. So I'm like, you know, I look at this, I look at these people were indigenous, and this connection to the land, that you go out, you pick food from this plant, and in a few months' time, it's going to reproduce more food again. That's a miracle, that's a gift. Versus moving into this monocrop agriculture where now this isn't a gift, this is work.
Yeah.
And this is your ownership of it. It's a separation from the land. So when I preached on this, I talked about this curse amongst the list of other curses as a separation from. So this is a separation from land.
Yeah.
And if you think about the curse, when you monocrop an area over a period of years, you will deplete the nutrients base in that soil, and you don't know why. I mean, that's a mystery. Like, this land here produced prairie for 15,000 years. It ought to be good for producing grain. And then in 10 years' time, it's not good for producing grain. And guess what? You have to work harder to get the same plot of land to continue to even produce a fraction of what it did early on.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and one of the, that just reminds me, one of the things that we see, Laura, can you go back to the map
right before?
I mean, in these areas, talking about what happens to the land, it may be really great for a few hundred years or so, but eventually a couple of different processes inevitably occur. What happened here, and why eventually they had to move towards conquest to all the different regions is the process of salinization. So you have, it just becomes too much salt in the area, and it won't grow any more plants. So this whole region, pretty soon, they couldn't grow plants anymore. But they have these cities built up that depend on the food and all the surplus and everything, so then they have to start spreading out and conquering other areas. And we've seen, I mean, and the other one is desertification, of course. So desertification, once you use up the soil and, I mean, all kinds of different things lead to that, you need to expand and go elsewhere. So you've got population, explosion of population, needing more food, and you have increasing desertification all over. So it leads to, it's a nasty cycle, and it leads to a lot of warfare. A lot of warfare. And that's what starts to happen in this area. So, in a way that you just don't see prior to digging up the soil and doing monocrop agriculture.
Oh, this is a good question.
Yep.
I was just going to say, Jimmer's tribe has seminars and classes on gathering.
Hmm.
And one of the principles is you never take everything. Like, you have to leave a lot of the plants. And so even in your gathering, you have to not be selfish. And so there's, monocrop, you just go in and you just take everything. You sort it at home, you know, like... you just strip it and then deal with it later and sort your crop. Gathering, even the mentality of being taught gathering, they teach a sustainability that is a different mind shift. So, like, these people are going from sustainability to just taking everything. And so I see that happening.
Yeah. Well, what I was saying about the notion of progress... it's kind of how we understand progress, I guess. Because if we think of it just with the ability to live well with a group of people on a land base and let that land base continue to sustain us for many years, this is the total opposite of progress. Because now all of a sudden, the concept of progress doesn't even make sense if you're just able to live sustainably within a given land base. So we call it that to justify the sort of societies and civilization. This is the rise of civilization we're talking about here that we've created. But inevitably, one area, like where a city is located, that land can definitely not support that land base can definitely not support that population, right? So that means you got to take from elsewhere, and then you need people producing the surplus from elsewhere, and. For these big cities, the goal is to get as much surplus as you can from surrounding areas without too much of a revolt or, you know, where people can keep producing for you. That becomes the delicate political balancing act that starts to happen here. So the rise of cities leads to, that is the rise of civilization. Cities and citizen and civitas, all these things are related to civilization. So, So... main point I want to drive home here is all these changes are happening here, and as we move on to the next section here, we're going to zero in from Mesopotamia and Egypt to the two places where this is happening. Now remember, all this is desert here, and this is water, right? These places are not very inhabitable. So you have these major civilizations right in the middle of it, right here. We have Palestine. And that's where our ancient scriptures come from. So Palestine represents with Northern Africa, Asia, and Europe, three different continents coming together right in the middle of the Fertile Crescent with all of these political happenings and really the only good route to pass through. There's two major roads to pass through here that go right through Palestine, so it becomes a highly, highly contested area very early between all these great empires that start emerging all around here. Okay, how are we doing for time?
Yeah, I think it's a good spot to pause.
Okay, so we'll take a break on this section. You can look at the notes too. There's a few more things mapped out. Any other questions? And then we'll move on to the next one.
Or even that, I mean, that's a pretty big piece of information and a really significant, I think, reinterpretation. So even just thoughts or feelings on how that's hitting you right now, we can take a moment for that.
Yeah.
I'm just recalling, and I don't remember the details, but the Cain and Abel represents the conflict between the agrarian and the non-agrarian tribes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we'll spend a little time on that next week, but that's exactly what's going on there. Well, part of what was required to do all the monocrop agriculture was the digging of canals. And once they started to manipulate the waterways and stuff, it started to affect in the irrigation systems and all that. They started to have salt that was just sitting in those areas that wasn't being dispersed anymore naturally. So.
So I've been listening to the History of the English Language podcast, and it talks about the Proto-Indo-European language. Are you familiar with that?
Talk to Isaac.
Okay. It sounds, I mean, the story sounds the same, so.
Yeah. All right. We'll move to the next section. A new people forms, tribes in the period of Judges, 1250 BC. Okay, so I talked this up to right around 3000 BCE, which was, you have Sumer, Akkad, you have Egypt, and with the rise of Pharaoh forming in the south. One characteristic of all of these cities that form, this state apparatus that starts to take place, is you really have about 1 to 5% of the population that are elite and living well. It's a very, very small percentage. And just connected to that class, the elites, I mean, you have, I mentioned the temple, you have to have a temple in everyone, because that's what helps give it its like ideological and theological weight, its power. That's how you convince people that this is willed by the gods, right? So you have the priestly class that are connected to this. You have the rise of writing, and writing becomes really important, so you have scribes. The priestly class, the scribes, they're all part of this political elite at the very top. And you have some others who have to do like the work of gathering stuff from the peasantry or the other people, the retainers, that might be like another 5%. But you're really looking at about 80 to 90% of the population that are peasants just working the land, maybe doing some metal work or something eventually. Some metalworking, doing really, really hard labor, and at various points that eventually leads to large slave classes to do this work, because it's a lot of work, the shift to this way of life to produce for these big cities that are being built. And these cities, again, are kind of walled in. So you would have like the you would have the peasant agricultural class outside the city working the land, and pretty back-breaking work, and really just barely making it, because this is very different than subsistence farming. Subsistence farming, you're in a space where you're kind of left alone, and all your surplus takes care of you and your family. This, there's heavy taxation. A lot of what you produce working the land goes straight back to, it's the surplus that's taken away as a part of the taxation. So you're losing anywhere from 50, 60, 70% of your surplus is being taken by the kings in order to make these cities operate and for them to live the lifestyles that they're living. So it's everybody's always just like one bad growing season away, one bad weather event from not being able to make it, and then often selling themselves into slavery because of one bad year, because of all that's being extracted from what they're growing. So that's some background to just how these cities operated at this time. So here's Egypt. We have the lower Nile and the upper Nile. It's flipped, it's not north-south. And there's about 2900 all the way to about 1200 BCE. There's three different periods of this kingdom, but it's a major empire that forms. And their reach spreads north, and they totally control from like 2000 to 1200 BCE, they totally control this region of Palestine. At this time, it's called Canaan. So Egypt just reaches spread up there. What you have is a bunch of city-states. These are Canaanite city-states, but they're basically like vassal kings of Egypt. So they're controlled more or less by Pharaoh and by the Egyptian rulers, but they have a little bit of autonomy where they can operate. So Canaan had been colonized by Egypt. So all those who were just indigenous Canaanites have now wound up in these cities, either in the cities or living right around in the lower-lying lands, the floodplains, closer to the water, where you can do agriculture. So you have indigenous Canaanites who are now in a colonized place, who have been brought to all these city-states under various kings throughout that region, and they're working for these kings. This is where our story begins when we're talking about the Bible. We have now stories, archaeological records, and all kinds of things. We're right around 1200, 1250. Something starts happening around this region. We know that Egypt was weakening for different reasons, and we'll get to the reasons why. So Egypt's grasp, they weren't able to exert as much direct control on this region of Canaan. So now you have all these various kings of these little city-states that were vassal kings of Egypt, but now they have a little more autonomy, and they start to fight with one another. So you have increasing warfare as they start to compete with each other, and some of these cities, these Canaanite cities, just all the records show that right around 1250 or so, a lot of them are a lot of damage, a lot of them are destroyed. Right around that same time period, we have records of all these villages, these small villages popping up in the hills here. So down here, as you get towards the water in Canaan. Oh yeah, this is it. Okay, so all these regions, this is the low-lying land. All the green here, this is where the city-states were located. And this is where all the indigenous Canaanites were brought to work the land for the kings in this region. Well, right around 1250, when all this warfare starts to happen, this means kings are going to start doing more taxation of their subjects at this time. And they're going to get conscripted and drawn into war and all that stuff. We have record of all these villages popping up here in the highlands. This is all mountainous area, right along the Jordan River. So down here, just to get our bearings a bit, you have today Jerusalem down in this region, in the southern area. Here's the Dead Sea, here's the Sea of Galilee, here's Jordan that connects them. All markers that we've heard some from the Bible. So everybody's fleeing to the highlands. And the records show, a lot of these are villages, they're not walled or anything like that. And they were just inhabited by agriculturalists. Those who fled the cities as they were breaking down in that region, who had a sort of a exodus up into the highlands, and started to recreate, try to live into a different sort of way of relating to each other, who clearly did not want to repeat the patterns that they were coming out of, but had to figure out a way, after probably a few generations of, or several generations, of having to being conquered and brought into these Canaanite city-states ruled by Egypt. Now all of a sudden they had to learn and live independently again and cooperate with one another. We do have some different indications of, I mean, these are various groups coming from different places, but all actually originally indigenous Canaanites who are moving up to this area. The reason that they can settle here is because it's really marginal land. It's really hard to farm for surplus. So there was nothing up there. They brought with them some of their knowledge that they had for how to farm in this way, and they started practicing mixed husbandry, different animals that they would graze and work with. They started growing again fruit and nut trees, and stuff for various oils. They did have some annual crops as well, and they started practicing terracing on these hills. Mm. We know that they had like water cisterns, and they figured out a way to live and to relate to the land in a much lighter way. Not doing intensive monocrop agriculture, but mixed. And you can do that on these hills because you have different microclimates. So throughout the hills, they would have these sort of mixed polyculture ways of farming. And then they started to create these village communities where they had to eventually learn how to get along with each other and relate with each other.
But a key there, the population density has to be lower to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and initially, that's the case. Yeah. But that does point to tensions that emerge a little later. Yeah. Okay, so if you look at your notes here, under a new people forms, some Canaanites get sick of life with their cities and defect to the central and southern highlands in a mass exodus leading to social, economic, and religious innovations. These Canaanites from various tribal groups band together to create a new collective identity, eventually a 12 tribes confederacy known as Israel. Israel just means God rules. What I'm talking about here, this process, a lot of it just comes from some of the research that's been done in the area, but I'll point to a lot of stories throughout the text that we have to get underneath the text of it and start to see what's happening in it. So I'm really talking about the first 5 books, along with Joshua, and Judges is much more complicated. That has some stuff to do with later history. We'll talk about that. But especially in the Genesis, Genesis 12 through 50 is giving us a lot of insight into what's happening as they are coming together and forming as a people. I think Genesis 12 to 50, so Genesis 1 to 11 is basically the creation accounts up until the Tower of Babel. That's all put together a little bit later in Israelite history. Genesis 12 to 50, we could think of it like oral tradition that's been passed down for a long time. From different groups have different stories that they're bringing with them, these indigenous Canaanites that are coming back into the highlands, and they have their different oral tradition that they bring together. One of the early ones would be the story of Jacob and his 12 sons that gets located more in the north. Abraham and Isaac get added on a little bit later, and they relate a little more to the southern part of that region. But really, the central organizing story that starts to form and shape the identity of this people is the story of Moses and the Exodus. So with Moses and the Exodus, we have a story from one of the groups of people who would have defected, who would have left where they were being held, enslaved. And so it's very likely there was a group that came up from Egypt that brought with them this story of an exodus, where they were being held in bondage under Pharaoh. A lot of people date this around 1280. There was a particular Pharaoh in Egypt at this time some things that are said in the early Exodus pages connect us to that. And there was all kinds of conflict, and he was coming down really hard on his subjects and enslaving a lot of people to do his massive building projects. And that there was a people that had the story of this God who heard their cry and their groaning. And so there's this God who hears this cry and his groaning. They identify this God as Yahweh, and who leads them on an exodus, an escape out of Egypt, and eventually to a promised land. And so this story for these groups that are coming together up in these highlands would have connected, would have resonated for everybody. And now they don't just have their various gods that are coming together. They have this God, Yahweh, that they can all relate to as the God who liberates, the God who is leading us out. And then you have the Sinai tradition. And in the Sinai tradition, what we start to see, the Sinai tradition is where it's the giving of the Ten Commandments, the covenant, there's different covenants made. And I just want to read a few pieces of this, because this gets us to the heart of all the issues that they're struggling with as a people coming together and trying to figure out how to live together, but not in the way that they're coming from. Not that's going to lead back to the sort of hierarchical state rule. So I'll look, if anybody does have their Bibles, we can look and open to Exodus. Well, here, let's look at a familiar one here, the Ten Commandments. What if the Ten Commandments are not this kind of universal law for all times and all places? But what if it is a people coming to figure out how to live well together in a way that is not exploitative and is not going to lead to increasing centralization, hierarchy, and everything that they're fleeing from these cities, these Canaanite city-states in the region? So who is this God that they're following? Exodus 21. Then God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Remember, there's a lot of different gods at this time period, all connected with the temples in these different cities and states. So there arises this focus on worshiping Yahweh alone to make distinct from these other gods that are justifying these other ways of being and relating, and identified as the God who liberates, who leads the people out. And as you go through this, I'm not going to read them all right now, but you can do so and think about it as more of local communal norms that are being shaped and that is being offered, that is received by God to help them learn how to live well together in this these developing tribes that are relating to each other in this region. At the end, you have, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or male or female slave or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. This coveting, really, we start to see even later on here in the text, has to do with just not accumulating more than you need. Is there? What's the next one? Oh, that's the last line I'm thinking of. Okay, so check your desires, this need to accumulate a surplus now that has been developing with the rise of agriculture and all that, is something that they're going to try to resist. And so when we go to the next, to 22, Exodus 22, you start to see some other concerns that emerge for the people in the community. There's a lot of people that there's going to need to practice a lot of mutual support in this region trying to make it up in the highlands. 22:21, you shall not wrong or oppress a resident alien, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. You shall not abuse any widow or orphan. This becomes a really important theme throughout the rest of the Old Testament. If you do abuse them, when they cry out to me, I will surely heed their cry. My wrath will burn. I will kill you with the sword. We'll talk about that stuff later. And your wives shall become widows and your children orphans. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you shall not deal with them as a creditor. There's a different sort of economic system that's starting to take place here. You shall not exact interest from them. Strong prohibition against taking interest starts to emerge here, and we'll see it later in Leviticus as well, because they're coming together to form new kinship bonds. They're family. You don't charge interest to family in that way, even though that's the way it's done in these other states. And it goes on. If you read through these, you'll see a lot of different ones. Let's look at 23:10. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the wild animals may eat. You shall do the same with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, so that your ox and donkey may have relief, and your homeborn slave and the resident alien may be refreshed. Be attentive to all that I have said to you. Do not invoke the name of other gods. Do not let them curse on your lips. There's a lot of stuff mixed in here, because these stories got reworked and reworked and reworked and reworked throughout the process of Israelite history. They originally emerged as oral tradition, but especially with the rise of monarchy and various kings and temple scribes, its final form didn't happen until hundreds of years later. So stuff got added, stuff got pulled out. But we can start to see some of the earlier tradition and the oral tradition that came and was present, along with some of the concerns that the community was trying to bring together. Next book, I'm just going to read a couple more. Leviticus 25 and 26. I won't read the whole chapter. Sabbatical year. So we've got this concept of Sabbath, about taking a rest, of not striving to get ahead and accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. Now you have the year of Jubilee, 25:8. You shall count off 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the period of 7 weeks of years gives 49 years. Then the trumpet shall sound loud. On the 10th day of the 7th month, on the day of atonement, you shall have the trumpet sounded throughout all your land. And you shall hallow the 50th year, and you shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. You shall return, every one of you, to your property, and every one of you to your family. It shall be a jubilee. You shall not sow or reap the aftergrowth of harvest, the unpruned vines, for it is jubilee. It's holy. Eat only what the field produces. In this year of jubilee, you shall return every one of you to your property. When you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not cheat one another. Let me jump ahead. 23, verse 23. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. With me you are but aliens and tenants. Throughout the land that you hold, you shall provide for the redemption of the land. And it goes on to talk more about interest. But the 49th year is a year of jubilee for anybody who has accumulated too much of a surplus, or anybody who has fallen into indebtedness, all is wiped clean.
Is it the 49th or the 50th?
Or 50th.
Okay.
All is wiped clean, and there's kind of a renewal. There's also regular season, seventh day, seventh year. There's different periods of rest built in. This is this early community. Now, however well they actually lived into this, we don't know. It's 1250 to 1050, about 200 years. This was the experiment of the practice. And we do have a sense that they really struggled to do this well with each other. So for 200 years, they practiced these different economic arrangements based on kinship, coming together as family under Yahweh, the God who has liberated them, to start sharing, not charging interest, to interest-free loans, and helping each other out. So these are some of the characteristics related to that we see. So jubilee, I've talked about this. Jubilee is going to be really important when we get to Jesus. Jubilee is a really, really important theme early in Jesus' ministry. Yeah.
Just for context, with the 50 years, what about was the lifespan? Do you know? Is that going to be more like the second generation of the person who got indebted is getting free, or is that?
That's a good question.
I think there's always been people who like live in their 80s, but it's a small fraction of the population. So.
Yeah. Average lifespan was 60 to 70 years around that time, but then without the child mortality rate.
Yeah.
The child mortality rate was really high, like 30 years the average rate, but then without the child mortality rate, it was 60 to 70.
Thank you. Yeah, so for every generation or two, then things are released and go back. It's also the leadership style here. You don't have kings. You have judges who function more as like elders in the community. Decisions are made with elders overseeing. But it's much more of a non-hierarchical communal decision-making process that focuses on discernment. Gift economy, I've kind of outlined some of that, but bartering, trading, helping each other out, not charging interest, not transactional, based in trust, which is why this kinship thing is so important in the relationships. Hospitality. One story, I won't read it right now, but you can look it up in Genesis. I think is it Genesis 18 or 19? Abraham with the strangers. Actually, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah relates to hospitality too later on, the failure to show hospitality. But hospitality was really critical because you really depend on one another. And so Abraham is, there's a wonderful story of him showing that sort of hospitality. And then, as I mentioned, subsistence agriculture. So this is the characteristics of this early Israelite community when it starts to come into formation. And a lot of this stuff, a lot of the concerns that we see in Genesis 12 through 50, concerns over childbirth. Are there going to be people to work the land and to do the labor? Concerns over land itself and how land is shared, traded, acquired. Just basic concerns over survival and also trying to deal with the surrounding empires. One benefit is that during this time period, 1250 to 1050, all these larger city-states at this time, their main war apparatus was chariots. And they could not operate the chariots well up in this hill country. So they did have that they were able to, I don't know, go off the grid, so to speak, and be present there together and practice with this experimental economy. It's really rare in this period. I mean, this is the earliest account we have that we know of this sort of thing getting written down, because writing was still so recent, and it was only present with the, it was mainly the elites that had the tools of writing. So that we have echoes of stories from around this time period of a people who were actually able to get out, have this exodus out of Egypt and out of these surrounding city-states. It is a social revolution that starts to occur, a very early social revolution that we have in our pages of the Bible. Here's just another story that relates to this time. Manna in the desert. When the Israelites saw it, this is Exodus 16, 15 to 21. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" It's actually, the Hebrew is like, "What in the hell is this?" It's really strong. "For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, 'It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much of it as each of you needs, an omer to a person according to the number of persons, all providing for those in their own tents.' The Israelites did so, some gathering more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, those who gathered much had nothing over. Those who gathered little had no shortage, for they gathered as much as each of them needed. And Moses said to them, 'Let no one leave any of it over until morning.' But they didn't listen to Moses. Some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered as much as each needed, but when the sun grew hot, it melted." A really remarkable story. You know, this is the period of their wandering for 40 years and trying to be reschooled into living in a different way. And that, as we know, took a whole generation at that time. But learning to receive and take as much as they need, but not to accumulate and need a surplus and store and save up in that way. It is one of those early stories that points us back to these oral traditions of a different way and a different time. And if we think about Matthew 5 and Jesus talking about, you know, not needing, just have as much as you need for today, don't save up for tomorrow. Or we think about the Lord's Prayer, "Give us this day our daily bread." We start to see some echoes with this tradition, pointing us back to a way that did not depend on these surplus extractive economies and saving up. Okay, let me look at my notes. Oh, okay, and then the religion. So I talked about Yahweh a little bit. Yahweh is the one, I'm looking at the notes here, that shapes the collective identity of the Israelites. It is the God who hears the cry. This theme of Yahweh is the one who hears the cry and enters into the suffering of the people occurs again and again. A totally different concept of God, of the divine, than we're going to find anywhere else at this time period. And delivers them from slavery under Pharaoh. Through covenant, they become kindred of Yahweh and therefore kin with one another. A covenant is actually, a lot of it is about becoming family with one another. Not through a state, but through this God that has brought them all in. And then all the mutual obligations that entails. And in this time period, there's multiple local places of worship, shrines that are set up in different places. You see that a lot in Genesis, which also becomes important later on in the Old Testament. So this is a very local God for this people that's brought out from the Exodus out of Egypt, that adopts all these people and to become kin, to become family with one another, and practice this different sort of economics and this different way of relating to the land. I'm just going to say one other thing about this, because as we go forward in the text, we see a lot of stuff about Canaanites, and then we have the Israelites. And we know there's texts where Canaanites are condemned, and then it becomes very violent. Some of this emerges later in the tradition. But early on here, remember, they are just becoming Israelites at this time. They are actually indigenous Canaanites. So what Canaanites comes to mean and represent, as they talk about Canaanites and their gods, Baal, or whoever, Canaanites represent a connection to these various city-states up and down the coast. It represents a different way of life. It represents these hierarchical way of social ordering, surplus extraction, excessive taxation, competition, and they have a god in all of these city-states that justify, provide the ideological justification for this. So to be an Israelite is to be distinct from that. It is to be called out from that. It is to be, you know, really on a chosen people who's called to live differently, model something differently, and not fall into that way. But Canaanites are actually just ancient cousins. I mean, they're all indigenous Canaanites in that region. They just take on this identity as Israel at this time. So origins of the Israelites, our forefathers and mothers, are not ethnic here, but actually represent a very distinct way of life in that region that has fallen into this formation of city-states through Egypt's colonization. And they got out. So, questions, comments?
So on the map, can you go back to the one that had the tribes? Just for clarity for me. So when you have like the Moabites and the Ammonites, who are all the people that you see them warring with, and they're all in the hill country there?
Yeah.
So are those Canaanites, or is that like the Canaanites are specifically the city-states, and then those are people who are part of the way of life? Or,
you're talking about over here?
Yeah.
On the other side of the river?
Yeah.
Yeah. And these would originally be Canaanites as well. We get into those relationships a little later on in the text, but kind of distant cousins.
So, but what specifically when it's talking about Canaanites, you said that's the city-state, like the distinction between those, like down the
mountains
versus the ones up in the hills.
So this region, especially, is where you have the city-states. I wasn't clear on that. You do have other places where some cities emerge. I mean, like one of them is the Jebusite site that we're going to talk about when we get to David, that becomes Jerusalem. But during this time period still, Jerusalem, which is up here in the hills, is actually a city-state. So there are some exceptions, but...
Mm-hmm. During that time, the storytelling, genealogies are really important.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk about that a different day? Or?
We will,
like,
yeah.
Because, like, you talked about how, like, Abraham was from one section and Moses was from another, but, like, in that those books that you know the Bible, like they make them all related to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, the role of ancestors in all of this and genealogies. I can speak to it, but I'm wondering if Pastor Jin, you want to say anything to that?
Yeah.
Or Isaac? Yeah.
Well, one thing I would say is that growing up in this country, like people just regularly said our founding fathers. And yet most white Americans are not descended from the revolutionary period, but have come in the 1800s and many in the 1900s. But ideologically, mythologically, we somehow, you know, have our founding roots in that time. And so there it was likely storytellers that created a common genealogy to say we are related. So how do we know that we're going to treat each other like family and not stab each other in the back, take advantage of each other, or at some point exploit when the time is right? If we always remind ourselves that we are kin, then we are less tempted to exploit. And so there were storytellers in that time that wove the various tribal people groups together. And a common genealogy was one of those ways that people were put together.
Mm-hmm.
One way I think of it, even in our own community, is like we're coming together, different people, like the way that Shiloh Bethany, our predecessor church, and Church of All Nations come together. And so one of those churches has 150-year history, and another is 13 years old. But depending on how we tell it, it can be one people or two and coming together. So I think we have even some examples of that even in our own life together.
So the way you weave this, it really strikes me. I don't know why my mind went here, but Israel is essentially pockets of hippie communes. Right?
Yeah.
They're like disenfranchised with society and mm-hmm. structures. They don't have a place. They're never going to get ahead. And so they withdraw.
Yeah.
And in their withdrawal, they, like the hippies always do, go back into some indigenous narratives and try to live closer to the land. And they come together around common beliefs, like Yahweh forms.
Mm-hmm.
Ten Commandments are all, you know, as you frame them, are about living together well. And it really strikes me as like they're disenfranchised kind of hippie communes.
The only, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of parallels there. The only difference that I do see with that is that they, I mean, they're a few generations removed from it, but they are indigenous to that land.
Right.
As one difference.
Well, we have Indian hippies, too.
Oh, there you go.
Is this whole region Canaan?
Yes. Yes, this whole region stretching up through Phoenicia is Canaan.
It's a good question, because sometimes we refer to it as Canaan, and sometimes we've been referring to it as
Palestine.
But same area.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just looking at your Exodus story of to the hills that you're talking about, and I was cross-referencing the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and the story of Lot in particular, and just came to my mind, the angel actually said, go to the hills, but Lot was saying, can I go to that smaller city right there? And there's a story of people who are resisting that coming out, and it just stuck with me, so...
Oh, that's a great example. And that's, you start to see a lot, there's a lot of that in the text, but that is one really good example. So he goes, and then you see later on, you know, Lot's decision and the way that they welcome the strangers in that story, Sodom and Gomorrah. And as kind of an example, a parable, a story of the contrast in hospitality in some of the cities. Right? And then there's judgment for that.
This is a good time. We'll take a 5-minute break, use the bathroom, stretch, or whatever, and then we'll jump back into it. And then, like I said, at the end, if anyone wants to stick around, we'll have more time for conversation as well. So feel free to take a drink, whatever, and we'll come back in 5 minutes.
So again, we're just doing like these broad sweeps through the Old Testament. We'll do a little more next week. Before the last 2 weeks, then we get to Roman Palestine and Jesus' ministry. So these are, this is going really, really broad. But if you have specific questions, those are things that we can talk about more in Q&As about different stories and stuff. So Israel gets a king, monarchy, and temple. One of the things that starts to happen so I said 1250 to 1050 BCE is this time period of this the tribes up in the highlands. Around 1150 or so, we start to hear more and more about the Philistines as a threat in the region. We also know that there's a lot of record that up and down the coast here. So I was talking about everything that was happening around 1250, how Egypt all of a sudden was significantly weakened. We had all this like fighting and warfare amongst these cities. There were other empires also that fell at that time. Part of what was happening is that they're just identified as the sea people. But you have sea people who are coming from somewhere in the area of Greece, and they're attacking all these different regions. Mycenaean culture, different cultures up around, well, Greece at the time, Minoan culture on Crete. They fall, if you read Iliad and Odyssey, they're dealing with some of this too, the warfare that is revolving around these sea people. But we have accounts of other cities falling along here too. Egypt is in a long battle with these sea people. They were able to hold them off, but it significantly weakened them. And so they held them off, and because they couldn't fully defeat them, but just kind of hold them off, they wound up giving them this slice of land right along here. So the Philistines encroach. It's right up around this region. And they're there, starting around 1150. So we're familiar with... Sorry, I said the Sea People. The Philistines, there's indications that they're related to some degree, or one part of the Sea Peoples at this time. And so they wind up here in the southern region, and they're very close. They kind of, we see in the text that they do work out some truce and some ways of cooperating for about 100 years. But eventually, they start to want to move more and more this way. And there's also population growth in this region, so Israel is expanding south a little bit too. So it leads to escalating tensions at this time. The question is, how do they hold them off? And how do we survive as a people without compromising our way of life? There is some, they don't just rely on chariots. Their warfare and things, they are developing and they're centralized to a degree where they become a real threat. And so there's a battle in 1050 that we see recorded in 1 Samuel, where they're actually victorious. This is where the Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant. And a lot of people die, and they humiliate and defeat Israel at that time. So when we turn to 1 Samuel 8...
Can I just say something about this quick? Yeah. I think, like, if we think about what they're doing at this time, like, they're you know, off by themselves up in the hills, and they've got this pretty good thing going, and it's working out well. They're minding their own business, but all of a sudden, like, this enemy is coming upon them and encroaching upon them, and they've got to decide what to do, because, you know, it's been working out, but they don't have centralized leadership. They don't have an army. They're not, they're a band of villages. They're not ready to fight off an enemy. So to fight off an enemy, they really face a tough choice. Like, are we going to centralize ourselves? Are we going to become like the people around us so that we can maintain our existence, so that we can live? And it really puts them in a difficult place. Do we compromise our values, or do we go out of existence, basically? It's kind of the question that they're facing. Mm.
The next slide, Laura?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So 1 Samuel 8 is a really important text here, because this is Samuel speaking the words of the Lord, of Yahweh, to the people who are asking for a king. And he warns them, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons, your daughters, the best of your fields, one-tenth of your grain, one-tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves." If you read through 1 Samuel 8, there's a lot more there. But the people refuse, they don't listen, and they decide to go ahead with it. So this is, call him the first king, Saul. His only responsibility is just organizing tribes for self-defense. He does not have, like, a bureaucratic apparatus for taxation. He doesn't do any of that sort of stuff. He's from a wealthy family, and so he's got some power and influence, and his responsibility is military matters. So there's a couple of places that call him a king. There's others that talk about him more as a commander. His role is a little more like a chieftain. It is some centralization of power, but it's not to, like, full-blown kingship yet at this point.
You'd say that he's kind of a way that they can maybe have the best of both worlds. Protection and also not a full king yet.
Yeah. So he loses his son, of course, at the end of... We see that he dies in battle. And his son Jonathan, who would be the successor, also dies in battle. And there's a lot we could say about Saul, but I'm just going to move us through here quick. We get to King David then, who after a period of like 7 years... He is received by the people in the south, along this strip where all these tribes are gathered. There's, you know, some more in the south and some more in the north. He's received by the tribes in the south right away. It takes some time, about 7 years, to be received by everybody. One of the ways he does it is, I mentioned a Jebusite citadel, this Canaanite city that is present there. He conquers that area, and he turns it into it becomes Jerusalem. Really strategic location because of its proximity. It's kind of in between the northern and southern tribes at that time period. And he begins to, you know, there's that wonderful story where he's bringing the Ark of the Covenant back into the city. They've retrieved that. They've got the Ark of the Covenant back, bring it back. They set up this central kind of religious shrine in the city. And he begins to construct, it's starting to move more towards like a state religion. It's not fully there yet. There's still all the local places of worship all around, and he does not go against those. He's also borrowing some from the Jebusite religion that's present there. So a couple of the high priests that were there, he makes the high priests of this shrine. There is a theology there that's really focused on the place, on the sacredness of that place, and that becomes some of the Zion. The focus on Jerusalem as a holy city and all these things is actually comes from some of the theology that was present there prior, and so he integrates that as well. So part of what we see with David is this coming together of he starts to function more like a king. He doesn't have to do heavy taxation yet, because when he defeats the Philistines, he gets a lot of the cities that were under his control, and he gets some of the resources there. He doesn't do a lot of big building projects, so he's still not doing heavy taxation, but he is starting to centralize worship a little bit in this one place of Jerusalem. So these are some of the shifts that are happening. So there's, again, a lot to say about David. I mean, his experience on the run prior to becoming a king and what's going on there, along with his different forms of governance. But these are some of the main things I just want to touch on quickly. And then we go ahead to King Solomon. King Solomon is a really major shift from the way of David. First thing he does is assassinates other contenders for the throne, including his brother. So he moves quick to assassinate. He removes all opposition. He consolidates power. You'll see this on the second page here. He starts to initiate really full development. The apparatus has kind of been put in place now. It is Solomon who decides to go ahead and do a full-scale building project of the temple. So this is Solomon's temple. This is the first temple. He also builds his own royal palace, massive royal palace. He learned all this architectural stuff from the Phoenicians up to the north. And in order to do so, he needs two things. He needs money. So he increases taxation on the people. He also starts to conscript labor. So he puts the people to work for him. First, getting all the resources up in the north. There's like the cedars of Lebanon, and there's a lot of resources in the north. So he mandates that people have to spend 2 months out of each year doing this labor for him. Conscripts labor. In one text we have, did I write this down? Where he's conscripting, in 1 Kings 5, 27 and following, he talks about the 30,000 men for that he's conscripting for this labor. So they'd spend like a month out of the year up there getting the resources needed, then they'd spend a month in Jerusalem actually building the temple or his palace or whatever else. He does a big, undercuts influence of older tribal organization. He does a big redistricting project. This is one to break up some of the bonds that are built in these communities. Also, it's a way of making taxation a little bit more efficient. And then he builds up the armies. With the armies, he builds up armies of chariots. He fortifies cities throughout the kingdom, and he has one of these armies of chariots in each city. So huge, huge expansion of the state with Solomon. And like a lot of these cities we were talking about earlier, whether it's ancient Sumer or Akkad, or whether it's down with the ancient Egyptian cities, but also the other ones that are emerging at this time, Assyria, Babylon, he builds a temple. And the temple is a way of consolidating worship, and if people come to, you know, if people have to make pilgrimage to the temple, that's good for the local economy. If they're giving their tithes, that's also part of the taxation and bringing the surplus into the city. So temple has a lot of different functions. It's also around this time that a lot of our writings, because he starts to have a team of scribes and priests and everything else, it's around this time that a lot of this stuff starts to get put down in more detailed forms in the Old Testament. So there's the oral traditions, there's stuff that's been written down, but now it starts to be brought together in ways for political purposes at this time. So this is all happening under King Solomon. Go to the next one. So I talked about kind of the delicate balance of governance for these cities because they want to expand. They want to build their temples. They want to build their palaces. They need to conscript labor. They need to bring in surplus. They need to do heavy taxation. But if you do too much, then you're going to have some sort of a revolt. And that is actually what happens with Solomon. So when Solomon dies, Rehoboam, his son, is to take over and succeed. And there's a group of people up in the north that come and ask if he can go easy on them. Look at 1 Kings 12 real quick. So they come to him. 1 Kings 12:10. Your father made our yoke heavy, but you must lighten it for us. Thus you should say to them, oh, I forgot about this part. My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Right. Am I in the right part?
We have children.
I know. Yeah, euphemism. All right, next verse. This is the one I want to get to. Now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So Rehoboam was not receptive to their request to go easy. He did the opposite. Jeroboam was the leader of one of these work groups, corvées, up in the north that were doing all this labor. And he leads a rebellion, a revolt. And eventually, they succeed. So with this, there is a split. And now we have a split between the two kingdoms. This is in 922 BCE. Let me give you just a few quick dates. 1020 to 1000 is Saul. 1000 to about 940? Is that right? No, 1000 to 960. Yeah, 1000 to 960 is David. Solomon, 960. To 922, and then we have a split. So there is this growing monarchy and control over this whole region from 1020 to about 922, lasted for about 100 years, and now it is split because Solomon overreached, significantly overreached in his nation building and his building projects and all of that. Okay, next. Let me look at my notes, see if there's anything else I want to mention here. At the very bottom of this section on the notes that you have, so Solomon dies, son Rehoboam, this is 5:1. Son Rehoboam, the successor, ignores pleas from northern tribes to soften his father's harsh rule. Northern tribes then refuse his rule and choose Jeroboam as king. A split into two different kingdoms, Israel in the north and Judah in the south, Jeroboam establishes two worship sites in the north, Dan and Bethel. And these become, of course, the South really goes after these sites of worship. It's like pagan sites and different things. Consequences of all these shifts in this section, you do have stuff that I've been talking about, a small body now of ruling elite who could impose decisions on all, a standing army of professional soldiers, you have social and economic stratification, an agrarian tributary economy where rural areas, everything's being brought into the center. Mm-hmm. Development of a theology to justify monarchy through centralized religion, a temple state. Okay, I want to pause there quick and just say this. now this gets complicated because I know that I'm talking about David, Solomon. I mean, these are really important figures for us in the Old Testament and in the scripture and the reading of all that. We'll see that when we start to have a couple of different traditions emerging here in the Old Testament. One that rallies around the temple state and the theology that starts to emerge around it. And then we have still the village communities are still around through different parts of this, and they have kind of their local theology that is closer to some of the oral traditions that we're talking about, where these are retained. And you also have prophets start to emerge mm-hmm. who tap into the experience of the people. And you will see with that, oh, am I jumping ahead?
Fine.
Okay. That they emerge to remind Israel of its founding impetus, the Exodus, Sabbath, Jubilee, the offering of refuge to the orphan, the widow, the foreigner, and the poor. Remember who you are. So that's why a refrain, and I read in Exodus, in the Sinai account, this focus on the orphan, the widow, the foreigner, and the poor, and economics and all that. And we'll see as we go through the prophets, they're always going back to this tradition. They're always reminding the people of this earlier tradition, and they're highlighting the way that the kings, and there's many kings that follow now here, a lot. It's really messy. That the kings are betraying the tradition. And so, I know it's a different reading of the Old Testament. We're used to readings that either kind of do like a, they kind of flatten the text a bit, and they do a systematic theology where they pick out different parts and they kind of bring it all together and they unify it, right? Well, we read it through the Apostle Paul or through Jesus, where it's kind of all pointing to Jesus in different ways. And it does, but in a very different way. I think that what's going on in the pages of the text here is we now have developing an argument, a struggle over who Yahweh is, the kind of God that Yahweh is, and what the implications are for how they are to live and to organize themselves mm-hmm. as a people. Mm-hmm. And what we're invited into in the Old Testament mm-hmm. is to enter into this argument, mm-hmm. to be in the middle of that tension, and to struggle with that question. So we see, like, I mean, we see all kinds of stuff that is totally that of this way of these ancient empires, right? We see a lot of that in the text. And then we have strains. We have the great tradition that centralizes around the temple that very much mirrors all these other empires. And then we have these strains that highlight a kind of a smaller tradition that is still very much always present in these communities that the prophets tap into mm-hmm. and that they're reminding the people of and that they're landing on. Always pointing back to this period, 1250 to about 1050, this time where Israel really became a people. And why they became a people. Mm-hmm. And this will be really important when we get up to Jesus, because different empire, different context, different situation, but very similar dynamics. And Jesus, in his ministry and the people he references and the way he references them, is very clearly landing on one of these traditions, right? Mm-hmm. Jubilee becomes really important for Jesus, especially in Luke. I mean, Moses, a part of David's life, is referenced by Jesus. I mean, some of these great prophets. So we'll talk about that. We'll explore that and how Jesus taps into that tradition. But this is what's going on here. There is now a wrestling in the Old Testament with who Yahweh is and who they're called to be as a people. Pastor Jim?
I think when we talk about a kind of a struggle for who Yahweh is, mm-hmm. this might be a good time to just clarify a little further that this is the early Yahweh of the intertribal period
yeah.
before it, the centralizing into kings was a god of the tribes, a god of the villages, and then later becomes a god of the city and a god of empire.
Yeah.
We have a god of nature earlier on, and then a god of, you know, technology and military and temples later on. So mm-hmm. it's like an early Yahweh and a later Yahweh.
Yeah.
That we're talking about. So the early Yahweh is called the little tradition, and this later Yahweh that blesses David and Solomon and all kings after in their imperial ambitions is the larger tradition. And what John is alluding to is that when Jesus comes, the text, the Bible, the scriptures that people receive do have
Yahweh represented in both the little and big traditions, but Jesus seems to land decisively with the little tradition. The God of the villages, the God of the orphan, widow, foreigner, and the poor, and not of royal majesties.
Yeah, thank you. Another thing I would mention related to that, just to kind of maybe simplify the way that we're thinking about this, is that in the time of Egypt, what or who is sacred? In the time of Egypt, it's Pharaoh who's sacred. Right? In this move out of Egypt, in this 200-year period of Israel's formation, what is sacred moves back to the land, and Yahweh's very connected to that. And we see that in different ways throughout the text. Now with this building of the temple, it's Solomon's temple that becomes sacred. So it's a big shift in terms of where they identify Yahweh. And we'll trace that, and we'll see the shifts in terms of what is actually sacred as we go throughout history here. But in this time period now, everything that's sacred is being brought right into the temple. Pastor Jim there?
So in the north, Jeroboam sets up two cities of worship. Bethel and Dan. Coming out of such a centralized theology, I mean, is this a movement into like abstracting God? Because in the South, very clearly, the seat of worship is the temple in Jerusalem. And now in the North, you have God can be worshipped over here, and God can be worshipped over here. Is this like God is everywhere now, as opposed to God is here?
Yeah.
Is this convenience at work here? I mean,
that's a great question. Isaac?
The
research assistant?
The story behind Bethel specifically is that's one of the sites where Jacob is supposed to have met God. So that's a very concrete site of like a place where God has met people before. I would assume something similar for Dan, but I'm not sure the story there.
Right, but I think what I'm driving at is like the very notion of worship in the Temple of Jerusalem is that you are present with God. And so I'm just wondering if like now we're abstracting and we're moving into God is present in Dan, God is present in Bethel, which I think if I'm reading all of this correctly, is given the mindset of the Southern Kingdom, would be borderline radical, right?
Yes. I mean, there might be there may be a case for that. I see it from a more political angle. Bethel is clearly part of a tradition that both the North and South accept as sacred because of Jacob's setting up a shrine there. But Dan is a northernmost point of Israel. So then Jeroboam sets up a shrine at the very northern tip of Israel. I think he's making a political statement that God is as far away from what you think, where you think God is, right? It's kind of a sticking the finger in the eye of the centralized bureaucracy of Jerusalem.
Yeah. So then would you say, like, theology in the North is as centralized in the South, or?
It's not.
I don't think so. I think it's more indigenous and more village-like. And, you know, we say that God is with us, and God is also transcendent. And I think the Northern tradition is more God with us than the Southern tradition.
So kind of isn't it?
I think it's more the opposite.
Yeah.
I think in the North, they're saying God is with us here in Dan and here in Bethel, you know, and with us in our tribal and village life.
Just in general in the North, there is, I mean, there's still more of the local shrines present around the North at this time. God is still identified a little more with place in that way. And I do think it's a decision to not centralize as much. I mean, they are viewed as heretical by the South, absolutely. And we see this later on when we get to Josiah's reform, you know. And so throughout, and part of this has to do with geography, the North does always retain more of a village-like character. And the South everything does kind of start to revolve around Jerusalem. We really see this in Jesus' ministry, because so much of Jesus' ministry is Galilee, right? Is around that region. This is just villages. And they still are tapped in more to this, what we call the little tradition, more than what is present down in the south around Jerusalem. So it's political. It starts to be a different conception or way of relating to God at this time, absolutely. And they definitely get critiqued and demonized by the south at this time period. Okay. You look at the notes that you have for... I'm going to go through this quick because we're almost at 8:30. So the prophetic movement, older traditions and structures of the tribal confederation continued at the village level where they could, but this became eroded through the state structure. And this is everywhere here now. Ancestral lands are taken by the elites. Oh, we left that term in. Or maybe I didn't take it on that. Dispossessing increasing numbers of people. One example is 1 Kings 21. Which I won't read right now, but do read it. Prophets emerge to remind Israel of its founding impetus. The Exodus, Sabbath, Jubilee, and the offering of refuge to the orphan, widow, foreigner, and poor. Idolatry here, and we start to have strong emphases on idolatry, right? Was choosing the way of Baal, the Canaanite god, over the way of Yahweh. Again, these gods, it's kind of just shorthand for representing two very different ways of ordering oneself, relating to the land. It's idolatry is really about that. It's about what kind of social structure and ways of relating to the land are you going to have. I want to read, I'm not going to read 1 Kings 21, but Isaiah 5:8 quickly I'll read. Isaiah, 1 Isaiah says, and he's a southern prophet, you see here. Speaking to the south. Ah, you who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is room for no one but you, and you are left to live alone in the midst of the land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield a mere ephod. So, joining house to house, field to field. This is large landowners and rulers getting bigger and bigger and bigger and dispossessing more and more people from, displacing more and more people from their ancestral lands and driving them into conditions eventually of some form of indentured servitude or slavery. At best, day laborers. So in the north, they actually have a lot of kings. Part of it is because they split things up, and it just got messier politically in the north. They went through way more kings in a shorter time span than Judah did. Judah actually had some really key dynasties that emerged that held on to power for a long time. There wasn't as much of that in the north. Also, the north, just the way it laid out geographically, was a little harder to govern. But Assyria's strength grew up to the north. They're part of Mesopotamia up in the north. Assyria's strength started to grow. They were eyeing some of the cedars and all the resources of this land. They also were eyeing it because as the reason all these empires wanted it, a trade route. And so they all wanted to be able to pass through here. And so Assyria comes and the north tries to strike a deal with the south. The south says no, and the north gets conquered. So the north collapses as a kingdom in 722 BCE. So they go from 922 to 722 BCE, about 200 years. A lot of kings during that time. Can you go back just 1 second? So, there's different strategies that Assyria has as an empire in conquering. What they do is they take some of the elites and they send them off into other regions, other lands that they've conquered. And they take other subjects of other lands they've conquered and they bring them into Assyria. And they force a lot of mixing to increase their power. And so there's not as much of a chance of any sort of revolt or uprising amongst the people. So for this reason, northerners start to be viewed with even more suspicion by southerners. Because they're now a population that is mixed a lot with Assyrians, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, so that's where we get the phrase, the lost tribes of Israel. Because you can't distinguish them as a people anymore. They've been intermixed with each other.
Yeah, the capital is Syria, or not Syria, Samaria, that was conquered by Assyria. You know, we'll see later as we get to like Ezra and Nehemiah next week. There's just different reasons why Samaritans are really looked down upon by those in Judah, those around the temple and everything. And that's we see that in the Gospels too, right? All Jesus' encounters with, or his stories about Samaritans. So Assyrian conquest of Israel, and then the next one. All right, King Josiah's reforms. So I write, this was an assertion of national identity rising out of Assyria's shadow. So Assyria is dominant, but they want to make a move to claim some of that northern land. They shift to a really hard and purist monotheism. They take a religious route. If they can like just crack down on all these local sites of worship, fully centralize everything in the temple. This is where there's this story about finding the Book of the Law. There's no hints at that in any of the earlier writings. This is likely something that King Josiah and his people kind of came up with to just tell the people. Remember, the people can't read or anything. If he just tells them, like, we just discovered this and this is what it says, and we have to purify this. What it really is a crackdown on all these other local sites of worship. It outlaws anything outside of the temple. And then the next note I write here, if you compare Josiah and Joshua, and if you compare the text, there's a lot of parallels, a lot, almost like word for word at different points. So what scholars have now come to today, a lot of scholars, is that this is actually the background of the book of Joshua. Joshua functions as the ideal leader meant to be read as a type of Josiah. Just as Joshua purges the land of pagan Canaanites, so Josiah purges the land of pagan places of worship. It's a book of violence to terrify the population into obedience. So again, all these books are being written at different times throughout the history. Joshua becomes a primary ideological tool at this time period. For Josiah to also advance a lot of his aims. So it is Joshua when we get the conquest and colonization of the Canaanites, Israel, and over against the Canaanites. As we said earlier, the earlier Israelites are actually Canaanites from that region, just moving up into the lands. There's also, we don't have any evidence, they've done archaeological digs in these regions. First of all, Jericho did not have a wall around it. There's no evidence of a wall at all, and there's no evidence of that sort of conquest of Jericho whatsoever. This is something that later on was written in. But this is a really, really critical piece of it, because this has been a primary tool that has been used in this country, as we know, this is a primary tool that was used in the conquest and the genocide here in this country of Native Americans. So how we read Joshua and some of these texts really, really matters.
Yeah. Is it a crackdown on local sites of worship for Yahweh or for Baal?
Well, now Yahweh is increasingly only identified with the temple. So they would even call these other sites that were actually practicing. I mean, Baal is actually just another word. It's just in a different language for God, same thing. So it's a crackdown on just worshiping, having rites, rituals of worship anywhere but the temple. Yeah. And again, this helps the economics, because now everybody has to come to the temple. It's outlawed to do it elsewhere. You know, sacrifices, taxation, buying goods in that area. So. Okay, and I'll end with this. Babylonian conquest of Judah. In 587 BCE, the southern kingdom, Judah is devastated and Jerusalem is taken. Babylonians pulled down the city's walls, burned the temple and the royal palace to the ground, and marched off the ruling classes and elite citizens into exile in Babylon. So Babylon conquered Assyria. Babylon is on your map. So Assyria is here in the green at the top. Babylon is down in the far east, kind of southeastern tip there, right by the Persian Gulf. It's Iraq, modern day. And so Babylon rises to power again, conquers Assyria, and then moves down, and as a part of that conquest, conquers the southern kingdom. So all the elites are taken from Jerusalem And so they're all taken from Jerusalem, they're marched all the way up to Babylon, and they're exiled in Babylon. And we're going to pick up there next week, because that's actually where a lot of the really key origin stories and some of the mythologies, Genesis 1 to 11, a lot of this starts to be written down during this time period of exile from about 587 to 539. As they're grappling with their identity now, as Israelites, but in a foreign land, and trying to figure out what is their identity and how do they understand themselves without the temple. Because their entire Israelite identity is attached to the temple at this point, and the temple has just been totally destroyed. And so they have to figure out a way to refound their identity. And to do so, they're surrounded by Babylonian myths that we'll talk a bit about. And in dialogue with that, and wanting to be different than that, they have other stories that are put down during that time period as well. So ruling class and elites exiled to Babylon. And is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. Destruction of the temple. So we will end there for tonight. Next week, we will do the second half from exile on and going through, especially focusing on Greece and all that's happening with Hellenism in the area. So. Yes, Corey? Or any other comments, quick?
Good question. In future weeks, would it be possible to get like a list of resources? And,
yeah.
Like, sources that you're going to grab out of?
Yeah. I do cite, so I can do that. I am not this creative.
Your wife has a question.
Yes. So.
Just a little comment at the end about King Josiah's poems that reminds you of how the missionary came to like my own country from the U.S. and how like everything was centralized, like the worship service, like the older the list that you did in the slides, it's just I don't know, it reminds me of the how the missionary came, the country, and then so now, but you said that it always like genocided the country here too, so that was just exactly sent it to. Probably not
with
Korea, but
other countries.
Like, spread out.
It reminds
me of the
missionary. Yeah, just to add on that, like, they forbade, rituals to the ancestors, which cut off, the ancestral, connection, and then, have it more centralized toward, the Christian doctrine, which actually gave rise to colonization eventually. Of course, the Japanese kind of, hijacked it.
And
so,
the temples were in the woods, right?
Mm-hmm.
The churches are in the
sea.
Yeah.
Well, being immersed in light Western theology and coming out of that background, and then seeing and learning some of that history, it really matters how we read this text and the decisions we make in interpreting and reading it. So that is all present there. Which is why, for any Christian empire that's looking for justification, rationale for what it's going to do, it's all there in the text because of some of this argument that we've been talking about.
Yeah, Josiah's team is very righteous.
Yes.
That's how I was.
Josiah is really
righteous. Very different story.
I know. Josiah. I'm reading through about Solomon again today, and I'm just like, oh my gosh. Like, you read through Solomon again with this in mind, and you start to focus on what's going on nationally and all the moves that are happening, the new administration and Trump, and, it's all that stuff is present there. And that's why, really seeing where the tradition that Jesus is landing on and their tradition that he is opposing and challenging and why is so critical, because otherwise it'll go right back to to Christendom, to Western missionary stuff, to all of that. The theology is just, it's embedded in the theology.
So King Josiah is a problem, and his wife Becky.
Right?
So we're gonna break, but if anyone wants to stick around for more conversation, we'll hang out.
Pastor, do you want to say a prayer for us?
Yeah. So let's close for prayer, and then.
Lord, thank you for this wonderful time to examine your scriptures. Lord, we do believe this is your word for us, but it was written by human beings who nevertheless were inspired by your Holy Spirit to tell a story of your involvement, your love, and your care for your people, which includes us and all those around the world that were made in your image. We're thankful that you are our sovereign Lord, and that that these are real stories of real people who struggle to be faithful to you. Help us, Lord, to learn from this holy text so that we may also struggle faithfully in our own time for life and for justice, for human flourishing in the times that we live in. Thank you for John and others' leadership tonight, and we pray that you would send us off to rest well, to work well, and to gather well together as your community of believers. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.